It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. You know, the Anchorage Museum is a very special institution for Anchorage. It's kind of like our front parlor. I don't know how many wedding receptions and events I've been to in the atrium. And it's a beautiful building, and it's something that I think people feel a lot of ownership for. It also happens to be one of the number one tourist attractions in Alaska. The buses pull up and enormous numbers of people go through our museum during the summer. So it's a building with many functions and with many audiences. And right now, the museum is thinking about how it will plan its future for the next 3 years. What are the priorities going to be? And they're working on a strategic plan. And there's also effort beginning to redo the Alaska Gallery, which is that big history gallery, which brings in most of the tourists and is also where our kids learn about the history of our town. And that's our topic today on Hometown Alaska, and we're hoping you'll join us. I have two guests in the studio. Julie Decker is the director of the Anchorage Museum. Thanks for being with us, Julie.
Thank you.
And Katie Ringsmith is the new history curator at the museum, formerly with the university.
Correct, and the National Park Service, too. Thanks, Charles.
Thanks for being here. And we would welcome and are hoping for your calls as well as you think about what you would like to see the museum be. What differences, what changes you'd like to see, what things you'd like to see enhanced or continued. The phone number here is 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And the email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. Julie, as the you're the new director of the museum, you've had some time to settle into that job, but you were there
before.
It's not like
a
new place for you.
It's new and familiar both,
What are you thinking about as you go into your strategic planning effort? What are you trying to find out about what your plans are?
Well, I think part of the strategic planning effort is to be transparent and open and to not assume that we know what everybody wants. So as part of this effort, we're making it an internal but also an external process. So interviewing stakeholders, members, potential members, people who think they never want to be members or never want to come to the museum, donors, volunteers, staff, board, to really get a sense of where are we now, where have we been, and then with that, make decisions about where we head in the future. Of course, I have my own vision for where I'd like to see us go, but I want to make sure that makes sense with our community and their desires, and that we don't make insular decisions.
Mm-hmm. So give us some examples of things that you would like to see develop or change, or things that you maybe are part of your vision for the future.
So I think as a museum, we've grown. We started as a tiny municipal museum with objects on loan in 1968, doubled in size in the 1980s with the oil boom, doubled in size again about 5 years ago. And I think this is a very distinct and exciting opportunity to say, okay, we've grown up. So how do we really develop that? How do we figure out who we are? And I think museums in general have changed and have had to change since this museum was founded. Museums were often just thought of as repositories, and staff was there to take care of those objects and to preserve them forever. And while that's still part of our role, the public plays into that in a much deeper, broader way, in a very critical way. So if we're not speaking to our public and bringing the public in, we're not really very relevant. And so this is an opportunity to step back and say, okay, we've added to our mission. We are art, history, science, culture. That's incredibly encyclopedic and an enormous task. And so what story are we trying to tell with that? What's our overarching mission? What are our values as the organization? And how does everything fit with under that? So while our aspirations have grown and our audience has grown, this is a chance to say, how do we make that mean something and really regroup and find our that storyline that pulls all of those things together?
Well, this past growth phase that you went through, which was a given impetus by Elmer Rasmussen and the large $100 million gift and then the big building campaign, also brought together some somewhat disparate elements. The Imaginarium, which is the kids' science museum, moved in. You already had history and art. It was Anchorage Museum of History and Art. And then you added the Arctic Study Center from the Smithsonian. Do you feel there's an issue there that you are you still have these disparate parts that don't fit together and you want them to fit together better? Or do you feel like it's that you do have that unified story that you're talking about?
I think there are ways that we feel disparate. I think when we talk about the museum in terms of those disciplines, we trip over ourselves and it becomes self-limiting. We think things have to fit in columns and boxes. And I think if we remove those lines physically and otherwise and say instead we're telling the story of Alaska in this northern environment and talk about the environment and people, then everything fits into that. Then you don't separate art from that because that's part of the story. You don't separate science from that because how do you separate science from when you're talking about the environment? And you don't separate history because history informs everything we know now. So I think it's really a move towards saying what story are we presenting and isn't that what people want to know when they come here or when they live here is the story of us as people and how we thrive or not in this environment and what are the challenges. So I think it's re-emphasizing that it's really the story we're telling. We're not trying to present distinct disciplines.
Mm-hmm. But I imagine some of the new things that have been built are probably not going to change. I mean, the Imaginarium part of the museum is so well built and elaborate and you're not going to I would think, plan to change that, or maybe you are.
The Discovery Center has been hugely important to us. It's expanded our family audience. It's incredibly popular. It's incredibly important to families in a northern environment that need a place to go in the winter.
That's right.
It brings people back repeatedly. But I think what we need to think about there is how do we keep that fresh so that when you bring your one-year-old back, there's a reason to bring your two-year-old back.
Yeah, I bet. You don't want the kids to say, I've already been there.
Yeah, that's right. So it's
have young kids. I'm sure you've heard
that. Mm-hmm. So it's how do you invest resources to keep that fresh? But I think also what we don't always communicate very well is that is not a generic science center. That is about the science of the North. And we really are trying to be specific and distinct in what we talk about in that gallery and what people learn. And I think, again, it's about helping people understand how that fits into our overall mission. And I think we can be more deliberate in that and really find those connections that mean something to people here.
Hometown Alaska. We're talking to Julie Decker, who's the director of the Anchorage Museum, about the museum's future. Where is it going to go next? There's a strategic planning process that's getting started, and we're interested in your comments and questions about that. The local number here is 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And email is a great way to get on the air, hometown@alaskapublic.org. Katie Ringsmuth, have been given the daunting responsibility of updating the Alaska Gallery. And this is a really large gallery that's on the second floor of the museum that attempts to present really the entire history and to some extent anthropology of Alaska from beginning to present. But it's not really to present because it was built a long time ago. And what's sort of the ending date of the existing gallery?
In the mid-80s.
Yeah, about 30 years out of date.
Yeah.
And a few things have changed in the way history is presented in the last 30 years.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just what they knew in the mid-1980s has changed entirely. And I think what Julie says is really important. There's this idea that museums are repositories of all this knowledge. But in Alaska, we're kind of on the cutting edge. We're still in discovery stage when it comes to our history and our history before contact. And so when you're talking about the Pleistocene to present, that's a huge endeavor. But I think what it does is it allows us to be relevant in that we can also be doing the research and showing it all at the same time. So that's what makes, I think, the Alaska Gallery really exciting. Because right now, we may not know, for example, why Anchorage is a 100-language city, 100 different languages are spoken in the school district. Well, perhaps this could give us the opportunity to really find out, to do that research, and then to bring it to the public immediately, and that's what makes it so exciting.
So give us an example of how that looks, because when I think of going into a history gallery, there's a diorama, there's some objects, and there are placards. And maybe there's... I mean, sort of there was a phase in museums where it was thought that, there'd be this great multimedia stuff. And so there might be a broken kiosk that you're supposed to put headphones on and nobody's using. Although the technology in the new part of the museum seems to work really well. But how do you create a more contemporary and history exhibit that has this flexibility you're talking about?
Well, I think that's a really good question that's going to be a big challenge because you can think, well, maybe technology is the solution to make it contemporary. But, when I was just back at D.C., you have little kids going up to you know, TV screens, pushing them and touching them, expecting them to do something. And so all of a sudden that technology is rendered mute. And mm-hmm. so you have to be careful with your use of technology, and you have to be very strategic in how you use it. It can be really important in conveying a lot of information in a very small contained place. But I think you have to have a responsibility and really think, why am I using this technology? That said, I think that the most important thing for the history gallery is that's accurate, for one, in that we reach and look to the scholarship and find out what is the most current scholarship and apply that, but at the same time make it a participatory event as well, too. How do we, as you mentioned, how do we make this the people's gallery and make it something that people feel like when they go to this place, they see their story. And perhaps it is a longtime Anchorage resident. They need to see their story there. But maybe it's a wife of a military officer who is overseas, and she brings her children to the Imaginarium and walks into the gallery. I want her to be able to see part of that story, too, even if she's only been in Alaska for six mm-hmm. months. I want perhaps people who have just migrated here and made Alaska their home from the South Pacific, for example. I want them to feel like this is their history as well, too. So everybody's story needs to be heard. It needs to be inclusive, and it needs to be inspiring, too, I think.
Well, how do you deal with the fact that Anchorage has changed really radically? I mean, certainly since this gallery was built, we've more than doubled in the number of minority, percentage of minority residents in Anchorage, and the diversity. We now have the most diverse neighborhood in the country, yeah. in Mountain View, mm-hmm. and the three most diverse high schools, which would have been completely alien to 1986 when they were building this gallery. How do you deal with the change that's happening that rapidly in a museum?
Well, I think right now the centennial gives us a great platform to start asking those questions. I mean, when you think of just the Upper Cook Inlet area, you have this wonderful history right here. You have Old Kinnick. Just on the other side, you have remnants of the Matsu Colony, of course, up in Palmer area. Mm-hmm. And then here in Anchorage, you have East High, which is one of the most diverse high schools in the entire country. I mean, mm-hmm. that's interesting, and that makes it very cool. And I think that's just really important to start really looking at not just the last 100 years and how that's relevant, but to really look at how we move forward. Is Anchorage important for what's behind us or in front of us? And I think the museum could be a place to start those conversations, and I think that'll be good for our community.
Whose voice, and jump in on this, Julie, as well, whose voice is heard in that gallery? Does it need to be a gallery that sort of represents everyone in Anchorage and everybody goes there and thinks that's, oh, yeah, that's right? Because if you do that, then you're it could end up pretty mushy, right? Or is it Katie's voice? I mean, or how do you figure out who's telling this story? Who wants to take that one?
Well, I think static exhibitions are naturally static, and there are some things that need to stay in place, and you can build flexibility around those things, mm-hmm. and technology is one way to keep things active and less passive. But I think Katie will be very good. What she does is find those voices and find the stories that speaks to a number of people, and so I think you'll see a variety of stories and first-person points of view in the gallery, and Katie's a facilitator for those voices. But I also think around that idea of a static, passive exhibition, because when you build something, it stays the same for a mm-hmm. while. What we're really interested in the museum and all the exhibits that we do is creating some experiences and some conversations, and because conversations aren't static and experiences aren't static, so we create environments that are immersive, or where you engage somehow and put yourself into that environment, or you can program around exhibitions so you have a reason to find an object, have a conversation about it, find a topic or a concept, bring people together, bring different people together who don't usually come together to have conversations. So I think looking forward, it's really how do we activate the space through programs? And while the exhibition has certain components that will be there, we make sure those are open enough and engaging enough that we can curate conversations mm-hmm. in addition to objects.
Katie?
Well, when I teach my history classes, when I taught U.S. history and Alaska history at UIA, of course I taught my students, hopefully, you know, how to go to the archives, how to write history papers, how to determine historical significance. But most importantly, I think, history is very simple and why it really matters. And our job, I feel, as historians, is to remember the voice of the people. It's that simple, to remember those voices. And perhaps in this history gallery, those voices are going to include clear visionaries, people who shaped history, Greening, Bartlett, Ted Stevens, of course. But it's also the people who the historical record may have forgotten or left out or completely ignored. Maybe it is the ancient Alaskans who crossed a land bridge and whose only evidence is remains in the domain of archaeologists. And it's really how to bring those voices to people today. Maybe it is the Chinese laborer who's... who fueled the canned salmon industry, which was one of the most important industries in Alaska, and whose names are entirely forgotten except for a machine unapologetically called the Iron Chink. And to be able to explain why that machine has that name is so important on technological, economic, and just historic reasons to remember the voices of the people who made our place pretty special today.
It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. That was Katie Ringsmith, the history curator at the Anchorage Museum. Julie Decker is also with me. She's the director of the Anchorage Museum. And we're obviously talking about the museum, where it's going. What would you like to see in that history exhibit? Have you been there recently? Do you feel like it reflects what you think of as Anchorage? What are some ideas? This is a good opportunity to let Julie know where you'd like to see the museum go in the future, and to let Katie know what you'd like to see in that history gallery. So if you want to get on the air, the number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752, and the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. Julie, you're relatively new as the director. You have taken over an institution that's gone through an enormous amount of change. In terms of its governance, it's now run by a private nonprofit, but is supported by tax funds. And it's in a massively remodeled and expanded building. But there's been enough time, I think, to sort of figure out how all that worked. You know, what the pluses and minuses of the remodel and of the new governance structure are. I guess starting with the building, what are the things that you like most about how it worked out? And maybe what are the things that you wish could have been done differently?
Hindsight is a beautiful thing. I think the building is actually a tremendous success. And while we can say, oh, I wish the stairs had been a different place or we had a different entrance, I think the main thing that it did was allow for the museum to be aspirational again. It gave us world-class gallery space, space that allows us to borrow collections from anywhere in the world. The kind of profile that says, we're valuable, we're worthy here in Alaska. We can rise to this occasion and speak on a national and international scale at the same time that we are a local institution and the community gallery and that living room is still there. So I think it's pretty successful in having found that balance. But it also turned the face of the museum to face downtown. Before we faced a little side street, this turned the museum around to face the heart of downtown, created a public plaza that offers a lot of opportunities for outdoor education and events, but really said, this is a community that it's going to embrace culture. This is a community that's going to look forward rather than just back. So I think it's been a tremendous opportunity for us. With any addition, and I think you can look at the greatest museums of the world and how they've added on, they would probably express the same challenges. But how do you navigate from old to new? How do you tell the public that, who don't know that what atrium means or go to the Alaska Gallery, how do you help them distinguish between old and new? Half of the building has four floors, half of it has two floors. So, how do you get to the Alaska Gallery when you're on the fourth floor? Take some challenging communication. So I think, again, we're in a stable place, which is a wonderful thing for any nonprofit organization to say is, you know, we're not just surviving. We're in a place where we can really ask those questions, look forward, look for solutions. And I think our building is part of it. We'll say, how do we make this one institution so that as you wander through it, you don't feel that there are lines between disciplines, lines between old and new. Mm-hmm. But as you wander around, you understand that this is a museum of Alaska. And regardless of what we're talking about or what objects we're showing, that's the story we're telling. Mm-hmm. And you're experiencing that just in different ways and through different stories.
So you mentioned being in this place of stability. Explain your governance structure and where your money comes from. Is there's an endowment that was created? Is that true?
Part of the gift was an establishment of an endowment, which is a critical element to our future. Endowments allow us to continue, provides that cushion, provides that stability. It's a statement that says
no budget cut can get you.
We're here for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then budget cuts can still get us.
Right, but I mean, they can't shut you down anyway.
The city still owns our assets. So mm-hmm. the city owns the collection. The city owns our building. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. I think that says that this is a city museum, that the people own this museum and the objects in that. So I think it's more than just a financial and bureaucratic statement. I think it's
And how much does the city contribute annually?
About 40% of our
budget.
Which
would be how much money?
We're about a $10 to $11 million budget, depending on the projects that we undertake.
Okay.
The rest is a combination of grants that we apply for to support projects, earned revenue through membership, admissions, our shop, the cafe.
So who makes
programs.
The decisions? Who makes the decisions? Who's the boss?
So we have a board, a governing board, mm-hmm. Which is a strategic board, but is also make sure we're fiscally smart and responsible. So we're accountable. We have a lot of checks and balances. That board is made up of members of the community, everything from business to education to industry, representatives of the community, representatives of the city, and they're there to make sure that we don't make missteps, that we are programming according to our mission, that larger picture is held true mm-hmm. at all times, but also that we're making good, sound financial decisions that aren't just in the moment, but that allow us to be stable into the future.
So as you go into the strategic planning process, will you be holding some public hearings? Will you be holding like community events where people can sort of give their opinion?
And we've already had a few. We had a session for our members. We talked to volunteers. We talked to boards of directors. We talked to leaders of other nonprofit institutions, Native corporations, artists, scientists, content developers and mm-hmm. staff and board. So it was already fascinating to see. We asked pretty simple questions about where do you rate us on a scale of 1 to 10. Those were revealing. We learned that we're hardest on ourselves internally than mm-hmm. maybe the public might be on us. And it's a start. We will have some targeted discussions as we work through our mission statement. We may send out everything from Survey Monkey, so there's an easy way to respond, to forums that people are invited to participate in and have some targeted discussions about what are we and where are we headed, and if this is where are we headed, does that mean something to you? Will you engage in that? Does this align with what you think you want for you, your family, your visitor?
Mm-hmm. Katie, when you're working on developing the Alaska Gallery, do you anticipate having some kind of a public involvement process or
absolutely.
Committee or something?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think you could go forward without doing that. Luckily, I wear lots of hats from the university. I'm also president of the Alaska Historical Society. I serve on the Cook Inlet Historical Society board, and I'm a mom. So mm-hmm. I hope to be able to reach a lot of different people from experts in Alaska history who have knowledge of very specific subjects to make sure we're accurate, but also those people who do bring their children to a museum and they don't want to enter an exhibit and the first thing they feel is like somehow don't touch. So how do we make it a space for people with varied knowledge about Alaska history? They have lived here for different periods of time. They come from different places and they're different ages, and so that's a challenge, but I think it'll make it that much more successful in the end.
And what's your timeline for doing this?
Well, we're looking roughly.
They're looking at each other. So
yeah, we're looking in 2017 is the current target.
Yeah.
So. Okay. So
and we're
got a
just starting the planning stages.
But
for
it's a huge, really big project. It's a large gallery. Yeah. Let's go to Rick, who's calling with a question about or a comment about history. Rick?
Charles, thanks for taking the call. Ironically, I tuned in after I got in my truck, headed down to the National Archives to do a little research while I still can. Mm. And what a treat to hear, particularly Katie. Here's my question for you. You've taught in the classroom, and Americans are notorious for not caring much about history. Is there some better way to teach it? It's so exciting, yet so few of us seem to be excited about it.
Well, that's probably a good point. I hope my students don't feel that way, actually. I think history is extraordinarily exciting. I was just at Washington, D.C., and walking in the mall, it makes you so proud to be in a place with such history. And then when you come to Alaska, we're just getting started on what we know. And I think you're right. The loss of the National Archives, unfortunately, I think is a larger symptom of people not supporting their history. And the reality is that that's got to come from the community themselves. They have to say, this is important and this matters. So you can't really capitalize history, that this has to come from the people, and people have to recognize that it is important. And it is in college level, for example, history, I think, is important because it goes beyond just credentials for a job. This is our responsibility as citizens of this country and as the state of Alaska. This is our responsibility to know our history so we can be participants in its future. And I think history is the way to do that. So hopefully we can teach it, continue to teach it well.
Rick, do you have any thoughts on how you make history come alive and be exciting for this generation?
Well, I think about it a lot, and I think there must be a better way, to take something so exciting and excite so few. We need to learn from Major League Baseball or something.
Well, I think about that. Just to push back a little bit on your question, we just last year or the year before had this amazing movie about Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment. And we had last year a movie about slavery, which was an extraordinarily 12 Years a Slave, very powerful. I think we may too narrowly define history into what we learn out of a textbook. And in fact, lots of media can teach us history, and we'll get into it if that is well-presented media and has stories and is, you know, has all the qualities that other media has, you know. And so I guess I'm not sure people are uninterested in stories. I don't know that they ever will be, and that's what history's made out of.
Yeah, look but Rich, to your point, we do have a baseball exhibit coming up next year.
All right. Yeah, that's really
that's
good.
Back, right.
Let's just get back to the top line here. Well, thanks for the call, Rick.
Thank you, Charles.
All right. So do you want to just to we're going to go to a break in about a minute, but what are some of the highlights that are happening right now at the museum that people like do your sales job? Your 1 minute commercial.
Here comes the pitch. So reaching our mission, we do a number of things. Some of it is behind the scenes from inviting researchers in from all over the world, artists, scientists, anthropologists, conservationists, other conservators and others to research our collection, use those objects. We don't want to just preserve them. We want people to learn from them. So there's a lot that happens, a lot of complexity to the museum that is not always front and center. In terms of exhibitions, we have very family-friendly, but also architect-friendly exhibition coming up called Brick by Brick, where we look at building toys and their impact on culture and creativity and the idea that one very simple thing can lead to something very complex if you use your imagination. We have the centennial next year, and we're doing a number of projects from an exhibit called City Limits that looks at our growth from a the tenth city to a very diverse place. So it's encapsulating that story of the growth of Anchorage in a very short amount of time and the tremendous change that took place. To looking for engaging public programs that tell the centennial story too. So right now with Alaska Public Media, we have a project that we're working on together. We have a van called the Vox Van that's going out into community to community to gather stories from people. Because again, we think if people can't relate to and place themselves into this place and our museum, then it's really not going to be interesting or relevant to them. So number of projects.
And the quake exhibit is still up.
The earthquake exhibit is still up.
And the Denine exhibit is no longer up, but it was an extraordinary exhibit.
But the Denine exhibit is currently at the Pratt Museum in Homer.
All right. Well, we're going to take a brief break. We've been talking about the Anchorage Museum with Julie Decker, the director, and Katie Ringsmith, the history curator. And when we come back, we're going to have a lot more to say about the museum and its future and what its purpose is. Is it for tourists? Is it for locals? How do those two missions work together? And we'd love to hear your thoughts. So when I come back, I'll be giving out those phone numbers. Be ready to give us a call and get in the conversation. So stick with us. It's Hometown Alaska on KSKA.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Hometown Alaska. Our topic today is the Anchorage Museum. There's a strategic planning process going on to figure out the future of the museum and what the priorities are. There's also a big project getting started to redo the Alaska Gallery. That's that big history gallery on the second floor, which is a major tourist attraction and destination of field trips for elementary school children in Anchorage. And Centennial's coming up, a lot of different events. So it's a pretty active place. And we have the museum director, Julie Decker, here, and the history curator, Katie Ringsmith, and we'd like to hear from you as well. The phone number, if you have questions or comments about the museum, is 550-8433, 550-8433. If you're calling from outside Anchorage, it's a toll-free call at 888-353-5752, and the email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. Katie, that last caller who came on was bringing up the subject of the National Archives. Earlier this year, the archives announced that they would be closing in Anchorage and moving materials to Seattle with a somewhat vague promise of scanning, electronic scanning of some papers. And it looks like that's happening. It looks like it's already underway.
Mm-hmm. It is. It is. And like I said, it is a symptom, I think, of we're not being good stewards at this point of our history, and this is being lost. But I think that there are things that we can do, and the Centennial grants was important. I was a recipient of one of them, and through the money I received, I was able to.
These are the grants from the Alaska Humanities Forum.
Yes, yes, I was able to photograph a map that probably hasn't been viewed by the public since 1915, when it was created by the Alaska Railroad Commission. And it is 13 feet long, 5 feet wide, and it was hand-drawn, and it shows Ship Creek. So this was the beginning, and we were able to get permission from the National Archives in Washington, D.C. to have it escorted to the Anchorage Museum, where it is photographed. I'm actually downloading the files right now as we speak at the back of the museum, and that will now be able to be accessed by people here in Anchorage, and that's a good thing.
But to play devil's advocate, I mean, what's it's expensive to run this branch of the archives. There wasn't that much usage of it in terms of the public coming in. And if we can digitize all the files, you know, what's wrong with that? Then you can get at them from anywhere. Do you buy that the files will be digitized and be accessible?
Oh, I think that would be impossible to digitize. They are asking historians and other people over the public to make suggestions on which collections should be digitized. And, you know, that would be great if that can happen. The reality is they weren't being used as much as they probably should have. And when I say we failed, I feel like I have failed as a advocate for Alaska history. I feel like you know, my students probably weren't in there as much as they should have been. I think it's very difficult here in Anchorage because we don't have a graduate school where that type of level of research is done. And so what I hope to see, what the positive can be, is working with Seattle through, like, the Alaska Historical Society and other groups to find funding for students and other researchers to go to Seattle, because Seattle actually holds a lot of collections that pertain to Alaska. And so not just make it a trip to the National Archives, but the University of Washington and other facilities that hold Alaska collections as well, and to make it easier and more accessible for students who may not be that comfortable mm-hmm. doing something like that. So I think that's the hardest thing in archives, is just being able to navigate through them and really understand, you know, how they can contribute to your project right. and your knowledge.
Well, this usage issue is a little bit odd, because of course the general public isn't going to be streaming through an archive looking at old papers. It's for authors and scholars. And there'll never be a huge number of them, yeah. but they communicate to others. They develop right. the knowledge that then is diffused. And so, anyway, let's go to Jocelyn. She has a question about movies. Jocelyn?
Hi there. Question for Julie. Why you no longer show independent films in the auditorium there?
Well, that's a good question, because that's something we've been discussing bringing back. We actually just renovated our auditorium. So for those of you who remember the spring sticking out of the seats, you can come back and enjoy your experience. But I think that's a good example. As we look to engage the public, there's a variety of media through which we can do that, and film is one of them. And there's incredible films being made here now and filmed here now. I think there's a really interesting film industry. So we've talked about developing a film program where we feature local talent in a variety of spaces within the museum, hold workshops so that we're part of the nurturing of that development of film artists and documentary filmmakers and others, because I think that's a very interesting thing on our horizon and something that we see happening here now. But in addition, we know that people want, especially in a northern place, a reason to come inside and have a great experience. So showing everything from A to B movies to C movies in the auditorium is something we're taking a look at, too.
Oh, great.
Great. I look forward to that. Thank you.
Well, it raises another question about the museum's function, because I remember actually watching years ago a couple of Werner Herzog movies mm-hmm. in the auditorium, and Werner Herzog was there and gave a lecture. And it was a amazing experience to talk to somebody who's one of the greatest directors in the world. But what he was presenting had nothing to do with Alaska, right? He's a German director, and mm-hmm. he was presenting a film that was about South America. And so it strikes me, does everything have to be about Alaska? I mean, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York doesn't all have to be about New York. And or is it because you are this Alaska institution that you want to really make it about Alaska? How do you deal with that? I mean, is there room there to import culture?
Of course there's room to import culture, and I think that's important that we provide access to ideas from other places besides our own. So reaching out and bringing people in, and we have a distinct advantage being an Alaskan institution that people are interested in coming here. And I think by bringing them here, you bring in a new perspective on our place too, because you see what people are interested in. Sometimes you even see how it changes their work through their experience. You create a network of people that allows you to expand. Right now, we're bringing in artists from all over the world to participate in a program called Polar Lab. So they are coming in. What we're asking them is work with us over 2 to 3 years and really work on research and investigate the North so that we're influencing the story of the Arctic and the North as a institution and creating a forum for discussion so that we're part of that voice of the North that gets exported to the South, whereas our tradition has been that Southerners come in for a moment and then go out back and they become the voices for the North, and it's less authentic. And so what we want to do as a museum is use objects and people and our story and our resources to create that authentic story for the North that then gets exported. And part of that is bringing people in and exposing them to it and offering that gentle education about who we are and how complex of a place we are. So, yes, I think there's lots of exciting people to bring in and provide access to great speakers and great thinkers as part of what we do.
But it also brings up the question of who the audience is and finding that balance, right?
Sure,
your summertime
yeah.
audience is mostly people who are visitors and who probably don't know that much about Alaska and need an introduction. And then your wintertime audiences are maybe know more about Alaska. They don't need the basics. They're interested in Alaska, but they're also maybe interested in stuff happening elsewhere. And those are two different groups. How do you balance that? How do you find the right way to?
I think the lines are a little less distinct than they used to be. I think we do get residents in the summertime, and certainly when you talk about visitors, often the residents are coming to bring them there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that we don't have that local audience in the summertime. We're also running programs on our lawn and children's programs throughout the summer when people want to be outside, and outdoor education programs. So I think it's a stereotype of the museum that we're working to change, that we have these two audiences or one audience that people think we just serve the outsider. I think in terms of numbers, about 60% of our audience does come from outside. But even that idea of who the tourist is changing dramatically. It used to be everybody's coming on a cruise ship. Now you see increasing numbers of independent tourists, European tourists. And I think they're looking for a new experience. And I think Europeans are people who embrace museums, and they have a certain expectation of what they're going to learn and experience when they're at the museum. So it's changing how we think about ourselves and how we think about our audience.
And Katie, your gallery, your Alaska History Gallery, is kind of the number one spot where tourists go. And I've been told it's like one of the top indoor tourist attractions in the state. Is that on your mind as you think about designing this, about it, that you're introducing Alaska to visitors and that it really does need to be successful in terms of that visitors want to go there?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And part of it is challenging because I think our job is to take into consideration what people know about Alaska and what they think they know about Alaska, and to give them that very satisfying feeling, you know, that they can take away certain knowledge about Alaska. You don't want to just show them really cool, pretty things. You really want to send a message about who we are as Alaskans. And I think ultimately we are a bridge that connects people from all over the place. You go, as we mentioned, to East High, you're going to hear a lot of different languages at that school. You go to my son's Little League game up at Eagle River, and you're going to hear accents from all over because a lot of the military families play there. So I don't think it's such a leap to think that there's this kind of one static Alaska, and I think Alaskans represent a whole host of different people from all over the place. And Alaska historically has served as that bridge that connects the circumpolar north and the Pacific world. And I really hope that the gallery represents that, and at the same time, perhaps dispelling some myths about Alaska or misconceptions that somehow we're the end of something, the end of the road, the last frontier, right? I mean, the frontier is
not true anymore. Yeah.
Right, and it's only one part of Alaska. It's really long, you know, 30,000-year-old history.
Yeah. Well,
I also think it's interesting to think about. We assume that it's the tourist that's interested in learning about this place. But I think the people who love Alaska the most and are the most curious and the most proud of it are as Alaskans. And so I think it's finding ways to make that pride come out in Alaskans. I mean, we're great recreationalists. We have extreme lifestyles and extreme places. We still buzz over a snowstorm and breaking the snow record. I mean, we're here for a reason because we're passionate about this place, typically. And even the newcomers are incredibly fascinated by being here and what does that mean and what is winter going to be like. And so, you know, I think we're not just speaking to tourists when we talk about Alaska. We're just finding that way to say how are we all connected to this place in ways that are really quirky and personal, but also universal.
Mm-hmm. It's Hometown Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth, and I'm talking to Julie Decker, the director of the Anchorage Museum, and Katie Ringsmuth, who's the history curator. And we have time left for some questions and comments from the audience who might be interested in what's happening at the museum, or might have some criticisms or things you'd like to see different. The phone number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And the email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. It seems that, Julie, you come to being museum director from a different perspective than previous directors generationally, and also as an Anchorage, you know, person. And I wonder if you are more open or have, as part of your mission, an openness to locally produced culture and cutting-edge local culture. And I'm thinking in particular of the Light Brigade event that happened last fall that was where they projected multimedia on the front of the museum while dancers on trapezes were in their music, and it brought a large number of people to the plaza. And then there was a great after party inside the atrium. And it struck me personally that I wasn't totally sure what they were getting at with what the presentation was, but the fact that it existed really excited me, because this was something new. We'd never really seen an event like that in Anchorage. It's 100% homegrown, cutting edge, wild, lots of people are there. And I wonder how your vision, if that represents part of your vision for the museum, is making it a bit more hip, a bit more cutting edge, you know, not knowing exactly what's going to happen, that kind of thing.
Well, I think you've probably heard us use the term relevant a lot, and I think that's part of it, that I think the new audiences really want an experience. They want something distinct. They want something to tweet. They want something to take photographs of and put it on social media. They don't want a passive experience. They want an active experience, and I think part of how we change is understanding that new audiences want something to immerse themselves in and something to talk about.
But I want to take it in a slightly different direction, which is that the homegrown quality of this.
Yeah.
I mean, these are like local artists who have, you know, struggled in obscurity, and then suddenly, boom, they're up there on the big screen and doing something that engages the entire community. And it strikes me a little bit like the, the colonial America took a 150 years to start producing its own art. You know, maybe we've gotten to the point where we can respect our artists who come from here.
Well, two thoughts. One is that I think museums have a reputation for being institutions, being fairly conservative, not being able to be spontaneous. A certain elitist view of, you know, we stand back and the world comes to us. And so I think your question about do I have a different viewpoint on that, yes, I think, you know, we do need to allow for some risk-taking. Part of how we're going to connect the community is to invite the community in. And when the community comes to us with a project and says, you're the place and we want you to be part of the art community or whatever community you're describing, I think our answer shouldn't always be no. And so I think I'm open to big ideas. I think that's probably my history, and what brought me to this place is that I've always been interested in the big idea, and that sometimes the most impractical thing is the most effective thing. And sometimes if you embrace the impracticality of it, you end up with something pretty great.
Mm-hmm.
And so when this group came to me and said, could we do this? I think they were expecting a no. And, you know, and instead you move to problem solving. And I think it is very important to not say all our talent is elsewhere and we're going to export that in. That if we're really going to take risks, it's not taking risks on the known. It's
right.
Nurturing. It's allowing work to develop by taking risks on artists and dancers and whatever form that takes. And we're inviting a lot of art forms into the building, whether they're quiet or spectacular. And this was a fairly spectacular event, and it was an experiment to say.
A successful experiment? I mean, you talk about risk.
Yeah.
What was, I mean, in every risk, there's a downside. And I'm curious as to some of the, did anything go wrong or anything that you wish you'd done differently with that event or any of the other new stuff you're doing?
We learned a lot. I mean, I think, first of all, it was, internally, you know, are we really going to do this? And are we going to cut down all that red tape between the city and ourselves and permitting? And, you know, it's a decision to where you have to sigh and say, okay, we're going to spend the energy on this and we're going to come together and we're going to say there are some risks associated with this, but we think it's worth it because at the end of the day, 4,000 people turned out and that was they were crossing the streets and streets were shut down and people were engaged. And I think what really struck me in being there was that there were 4,000 people there and they were dressed as pirates because it was pirate pub crawl night.
That's crazy.
And it was this, it was what we seek, which is this incredibly diverse, engaged, buzzing thing, but it was also incredibly quiet. There was that moment where nobody was talking and everybody was watching and people were engaged. They were taken and they're still talking about it. And I think as a museum, we have an incredible facility. We have an infrastructure, we have staff, and we can embrace those big moments.
Mm-hmm. Here's an interesting email, which I think is directed to Katie. The listener asks, whatever happened to exhibiting collections? I'm a big museum fan and make a point of visiting them wherever I go. As you prepare to rework the Alaska Gallery, I'd like to encourage not to buy into the current fashion of stressing interpretive work over the display of authentic artifacts. And goes on to talk about some major national museums where you'll go in an entire wall is covered with a graphics and the artifact content is very low. And people have said, you know, well, let's teach. So, but when we go to museums, I think seeing something real is part of what makes it exciting, right? I mean, if it was all about graphics, you could do it on the computer. So how do you feel about that, the use of artifacts? And is that an important part of the history exhibit?
Well, that's a great question.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. It's one that I'm faced as someone who's written books and has lived in that world, writing and talking about history, but now having to do it in 3D. And that is challenging. And the question that I ask myself is, you know, what does this object mean to the people? And how do you convey that meaning to them? And there's probably different levels of meaning for different objects. And I think the most important thing is... we are an Alaska History Gallery, so it's important to tell the stories that pertain to Alaska history on global, national, state, and local history. But then to say, do we have those signature pieces that represent that particular history? And the challenge is, what if you don't? Do you ignore that episode in history, or do you figure out how to provide that context? And certainly with those objects, you want to find those objects that can best tell those stories, that underscore the themes that you want visitors to take away from, that they can take away and come back with a sense of, I have a little bit better idea of what Alaska's story is.
So the new State Museum is being built in Juneau, and they, of course, have an extraordinary collection of objects, and I've always really enjoyed the old history exhibit, which no longer exists. I guess it's been demolished. Mm-hmm. New building is being built, completely new exhibit. Do you feel like it's important in any way to not duplicate what they're doing, find a different way of telling the story? Or, I mean, we don't need two big galleries that say the same thing, right? And are you in touch with them and sort of figuring out what they're after?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. You don't want to duplicate, right? And I think even since 1985, the city itself has increased its cultural institutions. So we, you know, shouldn't have to repeat, for example, what the Native Heritage Center is doing and showing the visitors that go there. So I think it's really important to keep it in contact with
you
your colleagues.
Deeper. Yeah.
Yeah. And to come up with, you know, the stories that, one, reflect your collection, but also to really define how that collection fits with the goals, again, that you want visitors to take away with them.
Would you go out and buy objects so that you could tell the story better?
We may. And I'd like to stress the writer caller's point, which is that I think all content deliverers are struggling right now, libraries, museums, newspapers, everything. thing that's about substance, but what museums have that's distinct and that people will always crave is that real thing, and that's our authenticity. That's our authority. We can say we have the real thing. So everything's going to evolve around that, and we'll never replace that with graphics or technology. There may be moments where we think that enhances the experience, but it will never replace the object. That's what's always going to make the museum important.
I think one challenge, too, for example, is how do you convey documented history? For example, political history sometimes is difficult in an object exhibit. So, for example, one example I saw was called Signatures. It was at the National Archives, and it actually shows how you take very specific laws, court decisions that you just see the document and you're like, eh, but then when you put it in the context of what those documents did and how they shaped history, that's phenomenal. So, for example, if you have the document that says this is when, you know, fish traps became illegal, this is, you know, our state constitution, this is ANSCA, this is ANILCA, these are laws that didn't just shape Alaska, they shaped the whole nation, then you can, you know, think about clever ways of showing that kind of history, I think.
What do you think about the approach that was taken at the Museum of the North in Fairbanks, where instead of sort of the chronological presentation, it's highly thematic. And so things are next to each other. They're from totally different periods. And they sort of are connecting because when they created the display, they were looking at themes and different ways of bringing them together. There have been some fairly controversial new exhibits in Washington, D.C., where they're trying to present things in a new way that's not just simply one thing leads to another. Do you see using that kind of new way of presenting things, or you've not gotten that far in making decisions?
I don't know if we've gotten quite that far, but as a historian, I think that it's very important to have a story embedded in your exhibit. And I don't know if dates and timelines are exactly the way to go. Even when I teach, I don't think that's the most important thing for my students to memorize a whole bunch of dates. I think it's important in understanding significance, chronology, why things are important. But ultimately, I think that you really just want people to come away with that sense of, I get this, I understand that story. You want clarity and you want continuity. And the best way to get that, that's what you have to decide.
Mm-hmm. Julie, we've got about a minute left. How can members of the public express themselves in your planning process or in general? Just send you an email or call you up? Or
they can call and send an email and express an interest, and we'll find some way for everybody to participate. If they're interested, we want to hear from them.
And what's the best way? I guess you've got quite a website. Is it sort of everything there? Is that the best place to interact with the museum? And
all our contact information is on our website. The website's in the process of being updated, too. So hopefully there'll be easy ways to find these things. And as we identify those dates and key points for discussion, we'll make sure the word gets out there through a variety of vehicles.
When do you plan to finish your planning process?
We hope by November we have a pretty solid document that we're using to move forward and that will be adopted by not just us, but our board and our stakeholders and the public, too.
And that'll be your guiding document for a 3-year period.
Right. Correct.
Yeah. All right. Well, which comes right in the middle of our centennial celebration. So it's a great time to be doing it. Thanks so much for being with me. It was fascinating. I enjoyed it. Julie Decker, director of the Anchorage Museum. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Kitty Ringsmuth, the history curator. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Next week on Hometown Alaska, Kathleen McCoy is going to be talking about veteran health care. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Monica Goki is our web editor and audio engineer. Dave Waldron was in the booth today. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. Thank you.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.